Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. At the outset of his victory speech on election night last November, President Barack Obama laid out the journey. But was it the journey of a nation, his campaign, or both?
Tonight, in this election, you, the American people, reminded us that while our road has been hard, while our journey has been long, we have picked ourselves up. We have fought our way back, and we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
Of course, that remains to be seen. But joining us now to return to the slog of the American presidential campaign of 2012, when all was not sure in the Obama camp, is author and veteran journalist Jonathan Alter. He is a columnist for Bloomberg View, contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC, and he is a former senior editor and columnist for Newsweek, where he worked 28 years. Welcome to the show, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks very much, Ann. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about the title of the book, The Center Holds. You quote an excerpt from William Butler Yeats' The Second Coming. Can you read that excerpt, or do you know it by heart? And can you
tell? I know part of it by heart, but okay. Basically the way it goes is this was a poem that was written right after World War II, right after World War One. What am I thinking? In 1919, mm-hmm. I believe it was. And the poem goes, a very famous poem, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Now, I don't think things are that bad right now. The world was falling apart in a much more profound way in 1919. But I do think that the American social contract, the way we treat each other and relate to each other in our society, was very much on the line in the 2012 election. So what I was trying to do is tell both a campaign story. It is the first book out about the campaign. And I wanted to include what all of the neighborhood team leaders in Ohio were doing. You know, this is their story. And I'm sure you have a lot of listeners who worked for Obama and some who worked for Romney who will, you know, be very interested in the way the campaign played out day to day. But I was trying to elevate it and explain that the social contract that goes back to the New Deal was at issue. So Paul Ryan, who as vice president would have been assigned the Romney budget, had the so-called Ryan plan, and he described it as a rewriting of the social contract and an effort to get rid of what he called the hammock that was coddling the 47% that Mitt Romney, you know, talked about in Florida. So it slashed all kinds of government programs that have been around for many, many years, and took us back, would have taken us back really to a pre-New Deal era in terms of our definition of what government is supposed to be about. And you know, he embraced the ideas of Ayn Rand and other libertarians. And this is a very, very different idea of America. So that didn't happen. And that's what I mean by the center holds. And it's also true that I don't believe Barack Obama's positions are leftist. They might be a little left of center, but, you know, the Obamacare proposal, Obamacare law, for instance, this was based on what Howard Baker and Bob Dole and these Republicans were proposing in the 1990s and Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. It was not a radical plan. It was basically a centrist idea, as are many of the president's other policy ideas. So that's why it was called The Center Holds.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is author and veteran political journalist Jonathan Alter. His new book is called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. If you have a question or comment for Jonathan Alter, you're welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I definitely want to get to Ohio, of course. But you refer to 2012 not as the closest election, but perhaps the most consequential. You call it a hinge of history. And I wonder, is it the part of the hinge that is affixed to the frame of the door or the part of the hinge that's on the door itself? It's different.
Wow. Now that is the kind of question that I expected Stephen Colbert to ask me last night when I was on the Colbert Report. And he was kind of going there. He was talking to me beforehand. He said, I might ask you, is it a rusty hinge? Is it a hinge that fell off? But, you know, sometimes I think of it as a door hinge where, you know, a door either opens or it closes. And if Romney had won, it would have opened the door on a very different kind of America because he wouldn't have gotten everything he wanted, but he would not have been governing in liberal Massachusetts the way he was as governor and, you know, had to make all of these concessions. He would have been governing in a resurgent red state America where everybody from Rush Limbaugh to Karl Rove to the Tea Party would have felt that his victory validated what they had been doing in 2010 and since then, which was a fairly radical view of the American experiment. And so in some ways, Obama was the small C conservative. He was trying to conserve the progressive achievements of the 20th century and modernize them. And in doing so, that might sometimes annoy some liberals who didn't think Obamacare went far enough. But in general, he saw himself as the custodian of the programs for the middle class that had, first of all, brought millions of people into the middle class and then sustained that for a long time. Now, that's been under assault for a couple of decades now, that middle class view of America. And so it was no accident that when Obama heard, I believe it was in an Ohio focus group from a woman in a focus group, and the Obama campaign heard her say in 2011, this is a make-or-break moment for the middle class. And then you noticed how that ended up in the president's speeches, because that's the way he viewed this election, that if you, just to take one example, if you slashed Pell Grants and college loan programs the way Romney and Ryan were proposing to do, really hard to get a job in the global economy if you don't have a college education. And it would mean millions fewer people would have that opportunity. Now, there are a lot of things that need to be done on college completion, and it's true that in some cases some of that Pell Grant money is wasted when people drop out. And those are all issues that need to be dealt with. And the Republicans have some good ideas on those issues. But on the basic question of whether this is something the federal government should be involved in, this was at issue. You remember back in the primaries when Rick Perry said he wanted to get rid of all those cabinet-level departments, and neither Mitt Romney nor any of the other candidates objected. All that the press focused on was that Perry couldn't remember exactly which departments he wanted to get rid of. What I thought was more significant was that he wanted to get rid of so many. That was a kind of a radical view, and it was rejected. So now we have a situation where whatever trouble the president is in politically, and he is in some trouble, he's had a bad month, nothing that really threatens his view of things will become law because he has the veto pen. So the Ryan plan, for instance, went from being a very real possibility, repealing Obamacare went from being a very real possibility, voucherizing, privatizing Medicare went from being a very real possibility to being fantasies. And again, that's why I call this the center hold.
Ohio, if anyone wants to just jump back into the index of the center holds, Ohio took up one of the lengthier sections, of course. It became the proverbial ground zero again. How is the presidential race different, though, for Ohio this time around, in your opinion?
Well, you remember in 2000, the late Tim Russert, my colleague at NBC News, yes. Held up a little sign that said, Florida, Florida, Florida. I think if Tim were alive, he would have held up a little sign that said, Ohio, Ohio, Ohio. The Obama people believed that they really would be in serious trouble if they didn't hold Ohio. The Romney people got very frustrated because the numbers didn't change that much in Ohio. Among many, many interesting things that happened in your state in 2012 that I chronicle and try to explain, there was the fact that African-American turnout was higher in 2012 in Ohio than in 2008, mm-hmm. which nobody would have predicted in 2010 or 2011. I mean, people would have thought you were smoking something if you said that.
Mm-hmm.
White blue-collar voters either stayed home and didn't vote or were otherwise very resistant to Mitt Romney's message, much more so in Ohio than in other states. And that was a huge turnaround from the big Republican wins in 2010.
Due to a certain extent to the Senate Bill 5 and the whole right to work? Or
I think Senate Bill 5 was an undervalued part of this campaign. And also, the Obama people did a good job of explaining how the president, it had been unpopular at the time, but he did rescue the auto industry. And when Romney tried to claim that, oh, this is really just turning, Jeep over to the Chinese or whatever, this didn't play. It didn't work because by that time, the people of Ohio had been educated enough on these issues that they were not going to be susceptible to these ads at the end of the campaign. I think from either side, I think at a certain point, and you know this much better than I do, the ads all just became a big blur, and both sides' ads stopped having much effect. And so the campaign was fought out more on the ground, and I got really interested in how that ground game worked in Ohio and how the analytics that were used in a secret annex to the Obama headquarters in Chicago called the Cave, where these geeks worked, how the models that they built and the algorithms they designed, how that those were actually used by people in neighborhoods in Columbus, Ohio, and how it helped canvassers, and I'm sure there are some who are listening, go to just the right houses on a particular block. There were sometimes mistakes, but allowed a much more efficient way of walking a precinct and knocking on doors, and also changed the kinds of ads that you saw on TV because they used something called the Optimizer, which was a tool to really target who was watching which TV shows and then shaping the message for that. And so that I think everybody knows, and that the digital technology, that Obama had the edge on digital technology. I was trying to explain how he had that edge. Mm-hmm. How did he have an edge on the ground in Ohio? And to also to tell people who were involved in this campaign, who were working often long hours, you were involved in something historic. And my book is the first book about this, and I try to sort of explain why the work that they were doing was so important.
You're listening to Jonathan Alter, author of The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. If there's anybody out there who wants to talk about working on that Obama campaign, as referenced by Jonathan Alter, give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513. If you want to critique Jonathan's efforts last night on the Colbert Report, you can call us as well. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your comment, your question there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
Your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are now even better with the Member Card Benefit of the Month. Each month, show your member card at selected partners for extra discounts. The benefit of the month for June is the Wexner Center for the Arts. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission to the galleries all month long. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive the WOSU member card as your gift. Just visit WOSU.org. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News. Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. Good for discounts at more than 200 partners. Visit WOSU.org/member card.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour is veteran author, political journalist Jonathan Alter. We're talking about his new book. It's the first one out about the 2012 presidential campaign. It's called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. If you worked on that campaign, either side, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Have a comment or question for Jonathan, you're welcome. The president, getting back to what we were talking about just before the break, the president thanked his campaign staff and the volunteers during his victory speech. He really seemed to mean it. Let's listen.
To the best campaign team and volunteers in the history of politics. The best. The best ever.
I drag that out because often they stop in the first sentence. They don't go to the best ever. But you write about later, when he thanked the staff in person, that he became quite emotional.
Yeah, on the day after the election, he got choked up. And even before the election, when he was in Ohio and other battleground states, he was so impressed by the young staffers and volunteers on the ground, and when he would meet with the state directors, when he passed through, you know, he'd always say that it's the same. His friend Marty Nesbitt, who was traveling with him, would say, "It's the same dude, you know, or woman." You know, they all had this quiet, selfless dedication, where they'd want their volunteers or their people in the picture with the president rather than them. And the president said on several occasions, and especially at the Chicago headquarters on the day after, when he was weeping, you know, "You are better than we were." And I think he meant it. And as somebody who's a little bit older than the president, but basically the same generation, I see that myself, that baby boomers were, you know, more self-obsessed, I think. And there was a an idealism and a spirit that was quite different in this campaign and in 2008 than in what we saw in earlier eras in American politics. So I wanted to capture that in the book, but also pull back the curtain and tell people what was going on behind closed doors, both in the White House, the Situation Room of the White House, and in the Chicago headquarters and in the Boston headquarters where Mitt Romney's people were.
Chris in Toledo, you're on the air with Jonathan Alter. Welcome, Chris.
Hi. Actually, I was calling from Ohio, but I was just going to comment that, like, when I started working with Organizing for America, you know, we were the first office really to get up and running in pretty much every town that we touched in, and you know, it was like very, very early, like April, May, when we were starting to, you know, gather data. As far as, you know, like canvassing, asking people what they thought about the political situation and, you know, not even doing persuading speeches, just gathering data. And it felt very intimate and it felt very local. You know, there was a real sense of like, this is, you know, our community and, you know, grouping people together, especially in a very, very red area. We found that, you know, there's a huge, huge, like, surge of people coming out being like, you know, I've been a Democrat for years, but I've never been willing or able to talk about it because, like, the conservative Republican Party was so strong in some of these, like, farm communities and, you know, traditionally industrial, you know, towns. And once we got started, it felt like a very, like, a social movement. And I was just going to ask you, ask the question, like, what impact do you see this having on not just, like, the Organizing for America or, like, Obama campaign or the presidency, but, like, on politics in the future as far as, like, obviously a lot of social issues, like, with women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, and things like that were brought up. What impact do you think this election will have on the future of politics in that sort of sense?
Yeah, this is a very important question, Chris, and I think it will have a big impact. Not that everybody's going to be able to reproduce the Obama campaign, because as Obama's field director, Jeremy Byrd, told me, you know, we could have had all of the great analytics in the world, and it wouldn't have made any difference if we didn't have the volunteers on the ground. And some candidates just won't inspire that degree of devotion, and these new techniques won't mean very much for them, but others will be able to harness these techniques. And at the heart of them is a marriage between technology and shoe leather, between new tools and the kind of dedication that you showed. And you raising the idea of what was going on in red areas fascinated me when I was working on this book, because it used to be when micro-targeting was much cruder and didn't really, before it even really existed. And by the way, that phrase was invented by a Republican strategist who tried to get Romney to do more of this, to have a big data project, and Romney's campaign refused, which is a story I tell. But when in the old politics, these red communities would have been written off entirely because of limited resources. So, you know, the Democrats would concentrate on Cuyahoga County or, you know, other parts of Ohio that they knew were reliably Democratic, and they would have left people like you just really without much support in the rest of the state. But what they could do now was find and identify Democrats who lived in red areas. And remember, this goes back to Obama's 2004 speech at the convention, where he said, you know, we pray to an awesome God in blue states, and we respect our gay and lesbian, you know, brothers and sisters in red states. So he realized that there were people who felt differently than maybe the coloration of the state. And then his campaign was able to use the technology necessary to identify and reach and motivate those people, sometimes online and often face-to-face contact or Facebook friend-to-Facebook friend contact, which was huge in Ohio. The way they developed something called Facebook targeted sharing to get people to get their friends to come out and vote and return absentee ballot applications or all the other kinds of things that are involved in politics.
The Obama campaign never really left Ohio after 2008.
Right. That's right. And that was, again, what Jeremy Byrd and Mitch Stewart and the guys who were running the field organization, what they said was that this was critical, that they had people on the ground in Ohio who had that experience, that institutional memory. So they weren't starting from scratch in 2011. They had an infrastructure to build on, and that helped them survive reversals, like something like the first debate. You know, if you've built a strong enough organization, you can survive real setbacks. The biggest setback at first, and this is a story that has not been told, it amazed me that this was missed by so much of the national press, was in 2011, the petition campaign in Ohio to repeal the so-called voter reform bill that had been pushed through there, and they got more than 300,000 signatures, and then the Ohio legislature, as you know, repealed its own bill. The Republicans there, they knew that it would get repealed at the ballot. So they did it themselves in anticipation, but it's a little bit of a complicated story. They did not repeal certain parts of it that allowed John Husted to play a lot of games right up to the election, and the Obama people were hauling him into court, you know, throughout the fall, and there's a whole story about a judge rebuking him for saying that the judge's decision was un-American, which was not a very smart thing for your Secretary of State to say about a judge. So there's a whole backstory here of how efforts at voter suppression failed in Ohio. And if they had succeeded, if that bill had stayed in place, that 2011 bill, I don't think there's any chance that Obama could have carried Ohio.
There, in his victory speech, he thanked the voters, but he also brought up the issue of voter suppression. And here's what he said.
I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time. By the way, we have to fix that.
By 2008, everyone seemed to agree that better access to the polls was necessary given the debacle of 2004. But by 2012, access to the polls became that huge issue you mentioned, especially in Ohio, especially after the midterms. And yet it didn't seem to, you said that if that bill had passed, even if they got it on the ballot, there's no chance that Obama could have taken Ohio.
Little chance. Yeah.
But so it makes me wonder, do people support voter suppression or not?
Well, I think some of that is still to be determined in Ohio. And there's still a pitched battle over these things. A lot of the limiting of early voting, and interestingly, the Republican statewide office holders in the Secretary of State's office was basically breaking the tie in counties in Ohio in favor of more early voting days.
Right.
In some of the Republican counties, but in the Democratic counties where more early voting would hurt them, you know, they were against it and making it hard for souls to the polls.
The Sunday voting
and all these other things. And this was part of a concerted effort nationally, what I call the Voter Suppression Project. And it will continue to be fought out. And I think it's very short-sighted of the Republican Party in terms of their long-term health to try to limit the franchise, discourage people from voting instead of competing for the constituency groups that they're going to need. And I think they're starting to understand it on immigration reform, and this is one of the reasons why there very well might be a bill, because Obama did so well with Latinos, which I know is a little bit less of an issue in Ohio than some other states. But the backlash, the anger at this voter suppression helped to fuel turnout. So, Al Sharpton, for instance, said to me that in his experience, African Americans voted for two reasons, out of hope or anger. And in 2008, they voted out of hope, and in 2012, they voted out of anger. and especially given what Ohio had been through in 2004 with those lines, you could make a pretty good argument, as Bill Clinton did, that it was kind of unconscionable for people in the state of Ohio to want to risk going back to that experience from 2004. Election officials are supposed to make it more convenient to vote. That's their job, is not to put up impediments to voting. That really defies the duty of their office. And yes, there are cost limitations sometimes, but even when certain counties, had the money, they made it difficult to expand voting. So this was a complex war fought across a lot of different fronts. But in the end, the Republicans got the worst of both worlds. Judges overturned a lot of these laws and slapped down secretaries of state across the country, Republican secretaries of state, in state after state, and said that what they were doing was either unconstitutional or improper in some other way. And there was an angry backlash. And that's a lot of what powered the president's victory.
Brian in Worthington, you're on the air with Jonathan Alter. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thanks, Jonathan. I actually wanted to originally point out that, you know, Romney was a very poor candidate, you know, for Republicans and for anybody. He was not very popular with anybody, and, you know, he made an incredible number of gaffes. And you're talking about the 49%, and just, or the whatever. So he just was really, nobody was the least bit excited about him. So it doesn't seem like, I mean, if Obama hadn't beaten him, it would have been a miracle. But I also wanted to just take exception real quickly to your characterizing Ohio as this sort of redneck state with sort of hyperbolic, you know, talking about just the fact that they made it less convenient for a certain person to vote, not necessarily intentionally. I have no idea whether, but John Husted seems like a very fair, very good guy, and I don't think he deserves to be you know, painted as some redneck Jim Crow guy. I mean, this is just ridiculous, and I can't believe Ann's letting you, you know.
Well, we're talking about a very specific issue right now, Brian, but go ahead, Jonathan Alter.
First of all, I just need to correct you. I did not in any fashion characterize Ohio as a redneck state, and I didn't use the word Jim Crow. And you know, and I think you're quite right that the weaknesses of Mitt Romney were apparent to Republicans and Democrats. But the idea that, you know, Obama was obviously going to win this campaign, certainly a lot of Republicans, all of Fox News, they thought that he was going to win. So it's easy to say afterward, oh, Obama was going to win all along. That's not really the way it seemed last fall. And in terms of your Secretary of State, I mean, I know that he's under a lot of pressure from the Republican Party, both in Ohio and nationally, to get with this idea of limiting early voting, which for some reason he thinks is a problem. And I don't think it will stand the test of time. He may have a very bright future ahead of him in Ohio. I have no idea. But I think I'm trying to write history here, and I think in the eyes of history, efforts to limit the franchise in any way, really, do not hold up well to future generations.
I you know, Brian, I think that by almost any measure at this point, John Husted is considered as close to a moderate Republican in public office or in statewide public offices we have in the state of Ohio. I get your point. And the irony that he was willing to put forth a redistricting plan when he was in the legislature that the Democrats did not support and thereby might have changed the outcome of the outcome of the gubernatorial election is interesting. So, Brian, I get your point. We were just talking about a very specific issue, though. Thanks a lot for your call, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Take care. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. My guest is Jonathan Alter, veteran political journalist and author of a new book. It is called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, or you can email us, or you can check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Columbus on the Record brings you the week's top news stories with in-depth, thoughtful, and balanced analysis. From the Ohio State House to Columbus City Hall, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the issues and stories impacting life in Central Ohio. The show goes beyond the headlines to explore all sides of each issue. Watch Columbus on the Record Friday nights at 8:30 on WOSU TV and watch full episodes online at wosu.org/cotr.
Support comes from Meijer, a long-standing supporter of the American Red Cross's mission to provide assistance to victims when disaster strikes. Most recently, Meijer donated $500,000 to support Red Cross disaster relief efforts across the Midwest.
You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up and receive a biweekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, news about WOSU partners, and much more. Visit WOSU.org/email right now and sign up for the WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jonathan Alter, veteran political journalist and author. His new book is called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Naomi. She writes, I had done some phone canvassing for the campaign last summer. So when I got a postcard in the mail to tell me about an organizational meeting, I was very excited. I went to the meeting not really knowing what the purpose of the meeting was. I was amazed at the momentum of the staff of this volunteer organization. But at the same time, I had this overwhelming feeling of a cult-like following. I had to keep reminding myself this was for Obama. But it felt a little threatening in the crowd mentality of this meeting. We were there to discuss neighborhood canvassing, after all. I left with a rather uncomfortable feeling.
Well, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are some cult might be too strong of a word for it, but you know, in any movement, the people who don't feel the fervor can sometimes feel a little bit excluded, and that's common in social movements. And it's always interesting to hear reports from the ground. And what would really interest me is if people did get a chance to read The Center Holds, if they wanted to be in touch with me about how what I wrote about squared with their own experience, because I wasn't writing about a specific neighborhood team leader, a specific OFA organization in a specific town. I was writing about the campaign more broadly and trying to get into some of the tools that they used and to change politics. And just to get back to the first caller's question for a minute, organizing Obama for America has become Organizing for Action, also OFA, and it's still an open question as to whether it can function effectively on issues like immigration reform, gun safety regulation, and other issues. And after the 2008 election, OFA was not very successful and got beat pretty bad by the Tea Party in a lot of places. And it'll be interesting to see whether this time is any different. The tools that they used were quite different in 2012 and 2008, and we'll see how transferable they are. There are also a lot of businesses, and that are interested. Eric Schmidt, the head of Google, hired a bunch of people from the Obama campaign to set up a new business to sell some of the tools and strategies that worked in politics to the business world, and we'll see whether that works or not.
Amanda in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you. I just wanted to call and share my experience this last year voting. And I tried to, we just moved recently into Clintonville, and my husband and I heard about early voting. So we went in to early vote, and the early vote closed at 5. So I had tried to find it on the internet, the hours, and was completely confused. Then tried to go on the weekend, and I didn't realize that early voting was closed on the weekend, except for right before the election. So I'm sure that there's probably higher powers at work, but I just wanted to comment that I wish there was a way for us to complain about the inconsistency in voting hours.
So what you experienced in in an individual case was very relevant to the larger battle of this campaign. It was about things like, who was going to be able to vote early. And the reason that was so important to the Obama campaign is that a lot of Obama voters, whether they work on Election Day, maybe they can't get time off from work to vote or have other reasons to vote early, they tended to vote Democratic. So even in 2008, if you had just done it on the basis of Election Day, John McCain would have carried Ohio. But because Obama won so overwhelmingly in the early voting in 2008, Republicans were strongly incentivized to try to do whatever they could to make it, a little more difficult to vote early. And that was a huge bone of contention that went into the courts and had some very dramatic moments of squabbling. I mean, it's only a small part of my campaign, of my book, and of the Obama campaign. I'm also writing about what happened in the Situation Room when they were getting Bin Laden, and what happened to Obamacare in the Supreme Court, and why Obama flubbed the first debate in prep. I'm trying to get behind closed doors, but I'm also really interested in experiences like the callers to see how they connected to these larger themes that I'm writing about.
Amanda, thanks a lot for your call. Kathleen posted on Facebook. She said, I would like Mr. Alter to talk about the role of phone banking in this and future elections. I did a couple evenings for Obama. When I left for the day, I felt pretty certain Senator Sherrod Brown would keep his seat, but wasn't so sure about Obama.
Well, phone banking was tremendously important for both campaigns. And interestingly, I have a scene where Foster Freeze, who was one of the billionaire super PAC guys who was on the Republican side, he said he went to a phone bank in Nevada, and he said that he could tell from the phone bank that Romney wasn't going to win. So sometimes, one's individual experience can be right, it can be wrong. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting about the way phone banks are evolving is a lot of it is now done from home, although if you go into the phone bank, you can make more calls because of the automatic dialers. So they still like people to go in person. But the big development in this campaign is a lot of the phone banking was done from states like California into Ohio, because the Obama campaign wanted to free up the Ohio volunteers to do more canvassing. So they had out-of-state volunteers doing more of the phone banking, although there was still plenty of that in Ohio as well.
614-292-8513 if you have a question for Jonathan Alter. In a column about a pair of Perry County, Ohio twins who are working for the campaign and they're, well, we all know here, mostly conservative home base. You made the point about what you later referred to in the book as the strange role reversal at the heart of the campaign. Romney was supposed to be the numbers guy, but the Obama campaign ended up putting them to shame, right down to the twin sisters of Perry County.
Yeah, that was when I was out in Perry County close to the election. I was really struck by that. I was talking to people on the ground as much as I could, and this was a great irony. Here you have Mitt Romney, very successful in business, a self-described numbers guy, and he doesn't do a big data project. He doesn't explore the digital possibilities, and instead he runs a Mad Men campaign. That was Stuart Stevens, Romney's chief strategist, who I've known for 20 years and was in constant contact with during this campaign. And I remember him telling me in 2011, we call them the Mad Men. And these were not out of the 1960s, but these were guys, a couple of whom had worked on Ronald Reagan's 1984 reelection campaign. And they had a very kind of old-fashioned view of how you win in politics. And essentially, Romney was running almost like a vague hope and change campaign, a feeling that maybe there would be enough of an appetite for change for people to fire Obama, whereas Obama was running a Bain campaign. He was running something that almost seemed like it was out of the business world. And so I just found that role reversal to be fascinating.
You wrote about Scott Prouty, right? The guy who videotaped Mitt Romney talking about the 47% at that fundraiser in Boca Raton. Tell us about this guy. You had a chance to interview him for several hours. How did he get in there and have the presence of mind to ramp up that memory on his cannon beforehand?
Well, I just got fascinated by the bartender who changed history. And the story really starts on a inky black night in the Everglades when Scott Prouty is working at a motorcycle shop nearby, and he hears a crash, and he runs to the rescue, and a woman has plunged into a canal in her car, and somebody, a bystander, has tried to free her. He broke his arm doing so, and everybody on the riverbank, on the canal bank, is saying, "She's gone, she's gone." And Scott jumps in. He manages to get the door open. He uses a Bowie knife, cuts the seatbelt, frees the woman, saves her life, becomes a local hero for this. And then fast forward 5 years later, he's a bartender at this event in Boca Raton. And what Mitt Romney is saying, not just about the 47%, but about Chinese slave labor, inspires his conscience, inflames his conscience. And he goes home. He has put the extra memory card in. You know, he's got all 68 minutes, but he doesn't watch the tape for 2 weeks because he knows he'll probably lose his job. His life will change in ways that aren't good, although it turned out that his life has changed in a very positive way. And, you know, he was a powerless guy. And he goes into the bathroom in the middle of the night, as he tells me, and he looks in the mirror and he says, "You are an effing coward." And the next day he starts to post these videos, and then eventually gives the full video to David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. And I asked him, like, "What was your motivation? Why do you think you did that?" And he said, "Well, remember the story of the drowning woman, and after that I felt if you can jump in, you should jump in." And so when he was trying to decide what to do, he said, "I don't want it on my conscience that Mitt Romney, somebody who he thought was praising Chinese sweatshops at this fundraiser," and he felt like yelling at him, "Hey, Mitt, what if your wife was working at one of those places?" He thought, as he said to me, mentioned Ohio. He said, if he's doing this in China, praising companies that pay people a pittance, in Romney's words, pay them a pittance, treat their workers awfully, Prouty, the bartender, said they'll be doing it soon in Ohio if he's elected. And he became very passionate about this. And his passion, I think, changed history, because if Barack Obama had gone into that first debate without a 7-point lead in the polls, which he had because of that 47% episode, and he had the kind of debate performance that he did, I think he would have slipped behind and it might have been very tough for him to catch up.
So, all right, let's talk about the first debate. What happened then? Because so many people were watching, waiting for him to take a sledgehammer to Mitt Romney regarding the 47%, and he didn't.
Well,
what happened?
His advisors gave him some bad advice, and they told him not to engage, to sit on his lead, which is never a good idea. The president actually wanted to get physical. Not literally physical, but, you know, to be more aggressive. They felt that in debate prep, where Obama was 0-for-6, he lost all 6 mock debates to John Kerry, who was playing Romney. They felt that every time they gave him a scalpel, as one of his debate coaches told me, the president took out a hacksaw, and they thought that it would create, you know, sympathy for Romney if he came out too hard. And so they backed way off. They didn't like the answers that he gave on the 47% that Obama gave in debate prep, because they knew that Romney would then say, "Well, you know, you have 47 million on food stamps because you're doing such a bad job on the economy." And then every time in prep that Obama answered that question, he went into a long, boring answer on food stamps that didn't win him any votes. Mm-hmm. And so the debate coaches are rolling their eyeballs. And so then his disdain for the process, the president's dislike of the theatricality of debates, he thinks they have nothing to do with actually being president, may be right about that, but, you know, as they said in The Godfather, this is the business you have chosen. You know, he needed to make more concessions to what was necessary. So even he knew that he had messed up badly, and there was a viral video that some of your listeners may have seen with Samuel L. Jackson, where he goes into a family's home and he says, you know, wake the F up, right? And so the president says to Patrick Aspard of the Democratic National Committee and a former, you know, an aide of his, he says, when I saw that video, I thought Samuel L. Jackson was talking to me, you know. That, and so in the second debate, of course, he did much better. He laid a trap on Benghazi that he then sprung. It was the whole thing with you know, proceed, Governor. That was all rehearsed. And so one of the things I like to do in this book is to, you know, everybody saw the debate. I wanted people to know what happened in the debate prep.
You coined the term, we just have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about the Obama derangement syndrome, which you said lingers today. But tell us what that says. Of course, that's a combination of things. What is a Obama?
Well, these are the people on the far right who, just looking at Obama, it drives them crazy. The birthers and others, you know, not all of them are racist by any means, but some of them are.
There were people like that about Bill Clinton, right?
There were people like that about Clinton as well, and there were people like that about George W. Bush.
Right.
There was Bush derangement syndrome, but it was it was bigger with Obama, and it backfired. It didn't work for them in the same way that impeaching Clinton, you know, the Democrats did well in those congressional elections during impeachment. So sometimes there are these backlashes, but the story of the birthers, the story of you know, Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and Roger Ailes and all the enemies of the president is very much a part of my book.
Jonathan Alter, thank you for talking about your book today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann.
Jonathan Alter, he's the author of a new book. It's called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.